everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy, my pal, Tom Fairbanks, engineering and producing the show on the other side of the glass. Tom, I don't really have anything to complain about with the weather today. It is absolutely beautiful.
And, you know, it's pretty much going to stay like this. It'll be in the mid-80s. I think we're going to be a tad cooler today, but then tomorrow and into next week we'll be in the mid-80s.
Going a bit above normal, 5 to 8 degrees above normal, but it's just really lovely. Hello, everybody. It's November 11th, Veterans Day 2021. We say a hearty thank you to all of those who have raised the right hand and sworn service to this Constitution and this country. All those that men and women who've worn the uniform, a big thank you to all of you. It's Buckmaster in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. Our radio station is 1030. Tucson's voice for trusted news talk. We have our worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com, and of course, KVOI.com. Our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Ted Maxwell joined the Southern Arizona Leadership Council, known as SALC, in April of 2013. Ted assumed the role of president and chief executive officer in July of 2018. The nearly 140 CEOs, business and community leaders of SALC are actively involved. They want to create a vibrant future for the Tucson region. A 1984 graduate of the United States Air Force Academy, Ted Maxwell served 15 years in the active duty Air Force, an additional 19 in the Arizona Air National Guard. Ted Maxwell retired as a major general in 2018. His final military position was that of commander of the Arizona Air National Guard. Earlier this year, Ted was appointed by Governor Ducey to represent Pima County on the Arizona State Transportation Board. In addition, he currently serves on the Governor's Water Augmentation, Innovation, and Conservation Council. He joins us in studio now. General, how are you?
Doing good, Bill. Thank you for having me in today. I really appreciate it.
Well, on this Veterans Day, we thank you not just because it's Veterans Day, but we want to thank all of our veterans every day for their service. And, you know, when you look at the numbers of active duty military in this country, it's 0.4%. It's a very low percentage of Americans who are current active military. Veterans, it's about 7% of our population. Things have changed.
Oh, yes, sir. They absolutely have. It's a, you know, back in World War II and the earlier conflicts, as well as through probably Korea and even into Vietnam, everybody knew somebody that was either in the military, serving to support the military in some way. But it was a much more of a way of life for the country. There was the interaction with the veterans were much greater. It changed obviously a little bit when we went to an all voluntary service. And it's, you know, I still believe we have one of the strongest and one of the best, militaries in the world, capable of defending our rights, freedoms, and values, not only in the U.S., but even throughout the world when necessary. But it has changed over time. And whenever I have a chance to thank veterans and speak to both veterans and currently serving members, I always try to take a pause and give a special recognition and thanks to the Vietnam veterans. And the reason I say that is the Vietnam veterans, one, many of which, if not the majority, were drafted. You had a lot of folks who volunteered. Throughout all the past conflicts, you had a lot of members of our country that stood up and volunteered to serve. But the unique thing about Vietnam is when they came back from Vietnam, they weren't given a true welcome home.
No,
in a lot of cases.
No, they weren't.
They were not thanked for their service. It was a time our country was going through, and their service, their saying, yes, I will go when the country calls me, I will do the best I can, and I'll come back, and was not appreciated, was one, I think, you know, a shame on our country. It was a moment that when we look back on, I don't think anybody's proud of. But what they really did is for all of us who now have served in the generations of a volunteer military force, the Vietnam veterans and what they went through created an environment for us. I have never in my 34 plus years of serving, never heard anybody come up to me and throw any of the insults. I think we learned after that, when we reflected on how we treated those veterans when they came home, that you can hate the war, but don't hate the warrior. Don't hate the person that's going out and trying to serve their country to their best of their ability and do what they believe is right for us as a nation. And it was those Vietnam veterans and the service they made and the lack of that welcome home. I always try to make sure that they know that their service was greatly appreciated.
You know, I reflect on my dear friend, General John Wickham, who is a monthly guest here on this program. He's 93 years old. He's the former United States Army Chief of Staff, and he tells the story, and he's told it a couple of times, and I want our listeners to hear that story of when he came back badly wounded from Vietnam, multiple injuries that to this day are still giving him problems. When he was at the military hospital, he was spat upon by out in the street. People would say, you know, calling him horrible names. And I reflect on that story as you were talking about how the Vietnam era vets really had a hard time when the transition was very difficult. And to this day, some of them are still having problems.
Yeah, there was actually a letter to the editor that was written in Today and talks about, and I can't remember if it was in the Republic or the Daily Star, but it talked about when is the war, when's service over for a member of the military. And quite often, the point made in this one, it was about the individual's grandfather who served in World War II. And
right.
His service was not done until the day he passed away, mm-hmm. because he had memories, had reflections, had, you know, conflicts. And a lot of our Vietnam veterans and a lot of our current veterans will always have what they carried, that burden of service, through the rest of their lives with them. And what I know all veterans appreciate, they do appreciate when people come up to you and you're in uniform or you nod or they learn in your service and saying thank you, because it's sincere now. Mm-hmm. People recognize that and they thank the veterans quite often. And we take this day to recognize all veterans. And it's different from Memorial Day, where we're recognizing those who gave their lives. Mm-hmm. But veterans, it's just that it's a chance to remember that those who serve the country did it to the best of their ability and with support for our way of life and our privileges. And I think too often people forget how our freedoms in this country are truly special. And if you know, for those of us who have traveled around the world, sometimes in areas that they didn't want us there and sometimes, you know, not, but I've never had a moment where I did not want to come back to this country because of the opportunity and the freedoms we have here. And I sometimes, honestly, I think we take that for granted. But the thing that has changed over the years is I think American citizens as a whole really value those who do serve. And you pointed out that the number has gotten significantly smaller than it used to be.
Yeah, and I'm from that baby boom generation post-World War II, and I was, when I was in grade school and going through school, everybody's dad or mom in many cases had some connection to World War II. They served, and these were, and their transition, in some cases, some of my friends whose fathers never really got over World War II. And had a very, very difficult transition. You know, there's a wonderful movie called The Best Years of Our Lives that was won the Academy Award in 1947 and talks about that generation that came back from the Pacific and from Europe and how difficult it was to assimilate back into society.
And that is so true, Bill. And what I am incredibly grateful for is the next generations. Mm-hmm. You know, as it, when I've spoken to some high school organizations and some others, there are still young men and women who are willing to serve their country, and recruiting for the smaller military, it's a tough job still, but there's an abundance of it going on. And the thing that amazed me about it is when I joined in 1980 at the Academy and then graduated in 84, if you had told me I would have seen combat, I probably would have thought you were crazy. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, we just come out of Vietnam. We did not see a situation that would probably happen. And since 1991, we've pretty much been in an deployable status ever since. And many of the young men and women after 9/11 knew the day they were joining that they would go see combat.
And many of them did 6-7 tours.
And they still put their hand up,
yep,
and said, I value what this country stands for, and I'm willing to serve. And that I think, on the younger generation, we too often forget. And
all right, let's take a quick call before we talk about my favorite bakery in town, Mona's Danish Bakery. Matt Laos, Matt, thank you for your service, my friend.
Well, I appreciate that. And happy Veterans Day to Ted and yourself.
Thank you.
You know, I was just thinking about what you were all saying. And, you know, to me, I remember being in the reserves in the 90s, and I did serve in contingency operations. We went from, you know, Desert Storm was a huge marker for changing the perception of veterans. I think it did a lot to really bring the country around to supporting veterans. But even during the 90s and contingency operations like Operation Joint Endeavor, where I served in Hungary, you still felt like you were lost, that nobody knew you were overseas, that you were serving. It was when you came home, nobody knew that we always seemed to have troops in harm's way, because we were a small force, probably 50,000 or less in total. But I think Ted will agree, the real change I really felt, because even in that period of time, if I'd wear my uniform in a large city, I would still, if we had had an operation involving, say, just a drone strike, say, you know, with a foreign, you know, group, sometimes you'd still get yelled at from people who thought that, you know, they were against drone strikes. And back then it wasn't right. Drone strikes, most likely Tomahawks. But the change came, and Ted, I think you'll agree, with 9/11.
Okay.
9/11, the just overpowering support of the American people and the realization that they were vulnerable, and yet there were people out there willing to serve every single day, 24 hours a day, to protect them.
Quickly, your comment here before we take the break.
Yeah, Matt, thank you for the call, and thank you for your service. As Bill already pointed out, the active duty has shrunk in its overall size, but the role of the reserve and the guard has increased significantly over the years. I do believe 9/11 was the push that showed that, hey, there are things that go on outside of our borders that we have to be concerned with, because we can be vulnerable. And there's no doubt, you know, I'll still give the credit to the Vietnam vets, because even in those first years after the first Gulf War, I never really ran into that things. I think, you know, any kind of citizenry that wanted to just speak bad about the military in general, you're always going to have some folks that are opposed to it. That's life, and that's the beauty of our country. You're allowed to be opposed to it. But I think it's always been a support for the warrior. And in those incidents right after events that occur, yeah, a little of that disdain may come out. But the fact of the matter is, now I think the majority, one of the institutions that has the highest level of support throughout our country, still remains the military.
All right, we're going to take a break right here and talk about my favorite bakery in town, Mona's Danish Bakery. Thanksgiving is coming up. General, when it comes to a pie on the table, what do you prefer, apple, pumpkin? Where do you go?
Oh, I'm an apple.
You'll
apple
go the
person,
apple.
All the way
all right,
through with
I'm
a nice go, big scoop of vanilla ice cream.
I'm going to go with pumpkin. Both the apple and pumpkin, both staples of Thanksgiving that are beautifully prepared at Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Think about a Danish Kringle on Thanksgiving morning. It'd be delicious to get the day going. They're located northeast corner, Swan and Sunrise. Open right now for lunch. They open for breakfast at 6:30 each morning. They do take Mondays off. Other than that, they are up and running and doing very well. Their website, monasdanishbakery.com. More with General Ted Maxwell right after this. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. You've heard me talk about choosing Tucson International Airport. While fewer people are traveling lately, our airport is doing even more these days to help ensure traveler health safety, including counter safety shields, physical distancing markers, enhanced cleaning, and more. It's called TUS Cares, and you can learn more at flytucson.com. These may be different times, but my priority remains to fly Tucson, Tucson International Airport.
The Regional Transportation Authority celebrates 15 years of project delivery to the Greater Tucson region. As promised, the RTA has delivered nearly 900 projects from its 20-year 2006 voter-approved regional transportation plan, which is funded by a half-cent RTA tax. The RTA is committed to deliver the remaining plan projects. Learn more about the RTA's economic benefits at rtamobility.com.
Why is mining so important? It's the foundation of everything that defines a society. Everything you see is a product of mining. No matter when, no matter how, no matter why, every society on this planet has developed, grown, and modernized based solely on the minerals it could process. That, my friend, is why mining is so important.
Brought to you by the Southern Arizona Business Coalition.
Vets working hard to save wildlife covered in cactus spines. A skunk left for dead, miraculously saved by a caring citizen. Those are just a couple of the headlines from the nonprofit Tucson Animal Rescue Center, where thousands of animals are cared for each year at its state-of-the-art Far East Side Tucson facility. Rescue, rehab, and release. The Tucson Wildlife Center, saving wildlife for more than two decades. Donate online at TucsonWildlife.com or call 290-WILD.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Are you searching for a sumptuous suite on the Italian Riviera, an exploration of the mighty Mississippi, or an indulgent spa in Cancun? Bon Voyage Travel will help you find exactly the vacation you're looking for anywhere in the world. With many cruises setting sail in over 1,100 hotels and resorts to choose from with our exclusive benefits, Bon Voyage Travel's experienced advisors are here to guide you every step of the way. Visit bvtravel.com or call 797-1110.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. General Ted Maxwell is my guest. He is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Southern Arizona Leadership Council. They've got about 140 CEOs, business and community leaders who care a lot about this community. General Maxwell also is the Pima County Representative on the Arizona State Transportation Board. So in our remaining less than 10 minutes, let's kind of take a quick, if we can, dive into some of these topics you're very familiar with. The possible route chosen for the Sonora Corridor. What is this generally? What's the bottom line with this, Ted?
The Sonora Corridor, really the intent is to, one, give access so that if you have transportation of whether it's goods, services from coming from Mexico, produce, you know, a lot of the goods that trade, we want them to come through Nogales. And one thing Sonoran Corridor will do in its final build out will give them the ability to cut from 19 over to 10 and head east. You know, some people say, well, don't you want that traffic coming through the center of Tucson? Well, honestly, if it's carrying a bunch of produce, they're not going to stop in Tucson. They're not going to come, they're not going to spend money there. That's not what they do. No. So that's one of the reasons. But probably more important for us is the Sonoran Corridor would connect the growth, job growth areas. Mm-hmm. It would connect the, you know, the Vail area where you've got the UA Tech Park, you've got Amazon, you've got, you know, out there, you've got Port of Tucson in that vicinity, and there's a lot of growing businesses there. You'd connect that with the airport and then connect it back to I-19 and down in the street area, which is also growing. So it gives us options. One thing Tucson lacks compared to a area like Phoenix and Maricopa is we don't have a lot of byways. So we end up using our surface streets a lot. This is a way to get some traffic off the surface streets and make it easier and more efficient, not only for the movement of goods and services, but also of workers to their places of work and employment.
When will it be done?
Oh, it's you've got to identify funding for it. What it's doing right now is just the tier one EIS is done. That was the selection of that. We still have to go through a tier two environmental impact study. That's the EIS. And then after that, we have to identify funding. Now, you may see some of that, and it's going to be a slow process. It's not going to immediately be this full built-out freeway-type corridor pass. It's going to start probably as a several-lane road and then build, because the funding is going to be pretty significant.
Did the Southern Arizona Leadership Council, SALC, have too much influence over the current redistricting of legislative and congressional districts?
Well, Bill, that's a great question. The irony of it is, for all the press that was out there, we had interacted basically three times with the IRC. We spoke at the listening tour, which was open to everybody in the public, and there was a lot of people. I mean, they heard over. We spoke at the north one and the south one, so the two they held in Pima County, and there was probably over 200, 250 speakers of that. We had our 3 minutes to make our case for what we were asking them to do. And then there was one email that I sent to the members. Now, we also had a couple members of the IRC speak at the CEO Summit, which is statewide. It's done with Phoenix Leadership and SALC and NALA out of
Flagstaff. But you and your colleagues on the SALC were not pulling the strings.
Oh, absolutely not. Like I said, we had three interactions, and the email that I sent was what got their attention. When we spoke at those listening tours, we made a case for communities of interest, and some people go, well, then you're really talking parties. No, we're talking communities of interest inside of Pima County. And if you look between 2002 and 2012, and actually we talked about it even earlier than that, we had a very strong Southern Arizona Pima County delegation.
In the 90s, too.
Because you had members from both parties.
Yeah.
So it didn't matter who was in charge. They could collaborate with each other. I mean, if you talk to former State Senator Farley, if you talk to former State Senator Engel, they'll all say that if you're in the minority party and you're at the state legislature, especially now, it's very hard to get your issues addressed. Nevertheless, Pima County centric issues, and SLC being a public policy organization, we're going to play in that space. So for people who think we shouldn't give our input, that's what we do. We try to influence outcomes, and we routinely would have to, for an RTA bill, we had to go to TJ Shope outside of Pima County, a legislature up in the Maricopa area, to carry our bill, because we didn't have that strength down here. What we've asked for is make sure that when it's done, as the second largest county in the state, 1.1 million citizens, you should be able to draw within the confines of Pima County districts that lean both Republican and districts that lean both Democrat. Because eventually you may see some swing on who the majority party is, but if the second largest county in the state doesn't have access to both, we've lost our voice at the state legislature.
I would assume you would say Southern Arizona and Tucson's best days are ahead of us. Why?
I believe that they are there because everything that's attractive about Tucson, our way of life, our environment, the quick, easy access to the mountains and the beautiful sides. I got a picture from my wife's dad's visiting. She sent me a text this morning. They were out hiking. And it's just, we've got so much access here, and we've got so much potential. 1.1 million residents. If we can get those residents educated and to create the proper workforce, our growth and ability to support all of those in this region, I think, are unlimited. But we have to address it.
Short-term challenges, police, fire, staffing, and Regional Transportation Authority roads.
All the above, sir. There's no doubt we've got to address those issues because everybody wants a community that they can live in, that they can feel safe in, they can play in, they can work in, and they can easily get around. So there's a lot of, especially on the infrastructure side and the workforce side, of issues we need to address. Let's address the issues of poverty and crime by getting people employed with good, high-quality living wage jobs.
You like the direction Pima Community College is taking, making a workforce ready. We've heard about workforces being ready. I have, anyway, in this community for three decades. It seems like Pima's really stepped up to the plate.
If you look at what JTED's doing under Kathy Prater, and if you look at what Pima Community College is doing under Chancellor Lambert, and you combine that with the University of Arizona's prowess, we have the ability to educate and train a workforce, whether it's in technical skills or educational skills. we can do that and create a workforce that then can lead to attraction of companies that are going to bring those jobs.
And younger people, so-called millennials, want to come here now.
They do, because it's the lifestyle. That goes back to that access to, easy access to hiking, to beautiful days. I mean, look at today. It's the middle of November, mm-hmm. and the day is absolutely gorgeous. Why would people not want to come here?
All right, General Ted Maxwell, always a pleasure. And again, we say thank you very much for your service. Quickly about the Guard and the Air National Guard, how vibrant is that component for our military community in southern Arizona?
Well, the military presence south of the Gila is just phenomenal. It really is. People don't realize that we've got over two-thirds of the soldiers and airmen that serve. And the Guard unit here is one of the largest in the country. We've got the fifth largest National Guard as a state. So the Guard here is healthy. It's got multiple missions. The relationship with the active duty at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base and the 162nd Wing is phenomenal. And it's a great place for young men and women who are looking at serving their country and attaining the educational benefits to consider joining, because they stay here. They're local. We are members of the community in the Air National Guard, and you've got that opportunity.
All right, General Ted Maxwell, thanks for sharing some of your thoughts today.
Thank you, Bill. I always appreciate the invite.
All right, we'll take a pause right here. Will Humble is coming up next, the former Arizona Director of Health, and we're going to talk about the latest with the COVID. Have a resurgence, unfortunately, of COVID, still very widespread in the community and the state. We'll talk with Will about that right after this.
Vero Amore Restaurant in Plaza Palomino at Fort Lowland Swan and Dove Mountain in Marana are now open for limited in-restaurant and patio dining, along with takeout and home delivery. All of your favorite Vero Amore menu items, including Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, are ready for you and your friends and family. More at VeroAmorePizza.com.
Have you ever imagined how your life would be without the modern conveniences you rely on every day? Everything you need depends entirely on products produced from mining. Without mining, think Stone Age. Your work commute might be a bit slower, but you could still have social media. Bathing shouldn't be a problem, but it won't be in a tub. So unless you're a caveman, you can see everything that enriches your life depends on the many miracles from mining. Brought to you by the Southern Arizona Business Coalition.
The average person in the USA today takes over 12 prescription medicines each year. And if you're over age 65, it is more than 17 medicines. CredibleMeds.org is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping inform you and your healthcare providers. Over 30,000 people die each year from reactions to their medicines. Don't be one of those numbers. Be informed and stay safe. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and take control of your healthcare by taking your medicines safely.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. And your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is once again welcoming guests to the gallery. Stop by or call ahead for a one-on-one appointment or even a virtual design session. Come by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, located at the southwest corner of Fort Lowell and Dodge. The number is 795-8226 and on the web at moesgallery.com.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
Welcome back, Buckmaster Show on a Thursday. Tomorrow we have our Friday Focus interview. Joel Feinman will be with us. He's the Pima County Public Defender. So we'll be talking with Joel tomorrow, along with Dylan Smith is going to be here from TucsonSentinel.com. Want to talk about green things, 51 years and still growing, 3384 East River Road, open daily, 13 acres of amazing plants. But they also have all that wonderful Talavera pottery as part of Zocalo Village, where they have beautiful collection of handcrafted mesquite furniture, Mexican folk art, beautiful lighting, home decor, some great items for Christmas. And don't forget the poinsettias. Thousands of them are grown right at Green Things. The website, greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com. Our live line, presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. On the live line is Will Humble, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association. He's had 30 years. He had 30 years of public health experience, still involved in public health, and we're delighted he is our Buckmaster contributor on public health. But his service with the Arizona Department of Health Services, that went on for a couple of decades, and there was a stint there where he was actually the agency director. He was the head person of the Department of Health from 2009 to 2015. Most recently, he has served as a health policy director at the University of Arizona from 2015 to 2017. He continues to be involved in health policy in his role with the Arizona Public Health Association. Will, how are you?
Good afternoon, Bill. Thanks for the invitation to come back.
Hey, Will, I'm looking at these daily numbers, 400 or 500 cases a day here in Pima County. Are we into COVID surge number 5?
Well, no, it's that Delta wave just never went down. I mean, the Delta wave really increased towards the last part of the summer, and it began about a month ago to look like it was going to go down like the previous waves have done. And this, it just hasn't. I mean, it just has stayed right up there. And statewide, I think 9 out of the last 10 days, we've been over 3,200 cases statewide. You're doing a little bit better, as you have been all along in Pima County, than the rest of the state, but it's widespread everywhere. And as we'll probably get into, mostly it's persons that, you know, have chosen not to be vaccinated, although we do see an increasing number of breakthrough cases. Those are people who got an infection, even though they had been previously vaccinated.
I got the booster a couple of weeks ago. Is that going to help my chances of not being involved with a breakthrough?
Yeah, it'll help a lot. I mean, it will help a lot. So that was good for you to do that. And quite honestly, I got my Pfizer's earlier in the spring, and I have been holding off getting my booster shot. But there was an article in Science Magazine last week, I think it came out on Thursday, which it was a study of a cohort of veterans that had of all different ages that got all different kinds of vaccines, and it measured both the breakthrough cases and also hospitalizations. And thankfully, the vaccines all stayed protective of hospitalizations and death. But increasingly over time, especially after 8 months, it showed more and more of them were getting breakthrough cases. So I've actually scheduled my booster shot tomorrow.
Yeah, I think it's a prudent thing to do. I did mine on a Friday thinking, well, Saturday may be a waste, and it turned out to be a waste today because, like shot number two with the Moderna, I did have a reaction, maybe not as robust as the shot number two, but some people are getting a reaction. They're just, you know, they're kind of down for a day, kind of flu-like symptoms, not feeling like even going out and doing anything.
Yeah, and that actually happened to me with my shingles vaccine about 3 weeks ago. I got my shingles booster. Well, I wasn't that bad. I might still functioned and stuff, but I avoided yard work that day because my arm hurt kind of.
So let's talk about, so why have we plateaued? You would think that sooner or later there's been so much of this going through the community that things are going to turn around.
Yeah, well, there's just the bottom line is there are enough unvaccinated people to keep this thing going because, and largely because, of the Delta variant. I mean, we've talked about it last month and the month before, I think. It's just so much more easy to transmit than any of the previous versions of this virus. And because of that, you've got to have much higher vaccination rates in order for this thing to go away. And we're just not there. I mean, if you look at the population as a whole in Arizona, we're still of the people that qualify for the vaccine. So that's everyone from 5 years on up. If you add everyone in the denominator, we're at 52%. And that's just inadequate for the virus, this Delta version of the virus. And so it continues to infect people.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Delta and what may be coming. There was a very interesting piece in Salon. I sent a copy of it to you yesterday. The title is Why the Coronavirus is Unlikely to Mutate into Something Deadlier. And that's the big fear, Will Humble, that there is something else perhaps coming, a mutation that's going to just really, really rip through us. What's your take on this?
I think it's highly unlikely that this virus is going to mutate to become something that is more, that causes more serious symptoms or that, you know, it's what we call more virulent. And it's basically, it comes down to the principle of natural selection and evolution. You know, a generation for this virus is a few hours. You know, for humans, it's 20 years. For a virus, it's a few hours. And so we get to see evolution happening in real time. And there's been a lot of tracking over the last 18 months to look at, you know, the ways in this virus is mutating. And like almost all viruses that do mutate, it's mutating to forms that make it more transmissible. Because if, let's say a virus, let's say it mutates into a form that's more deadly, but not as transmissible, it's not going to be able to compete with the more transmissible versions of the virus. And so, these more transmissible versions of the virus are the ones that end up taking over and dominating the scene, like Delta is doing. And quite honestly, viruses don't want to kill their host. They want to keep their host alive so that their host can spew more virus to more people, because their only goal in life is to reproduce. That's all the virus wants to do. And if you kill your host, especially if you kill your host fast, you're not going to be able to reproduce as effectively because you won't be able to spread it as far. So that's obviously, these viruses aren't thinking. They don't have brains, but the principles of evolution are at work. And that's why I don't think that this virus is going to mutate into something that becomes more deadly. We could see it become more transmissible, but not more deely. And as I think we've talked about in previous shows, a larger risk is that there will be some virus in the future, whether it is, you know, created in a laboratory or through interaction with wildlife or in some other way, some new virus that is more deadly than this could actually end up happening. So, you know, but not this virus itself.
This virus does have similar, has some relatives, SARS, and then there's that MERS. They were deadlier, weren't they?
Oh, they very much were. They were much deadlier, especially MERS. SARS, mm-hmm. The first SARS virus, too, from 2003, mm-hmm. Extremely deadly. Like, it killed more than 10% of, well, SARS, the first SARS killed more than 10%. MERS kills more than that.
Wow.
Fortunately, those viruses were not very transmissible. And so the first SARS virus had some cases in China. It leaked into Toronto, Canada, into a hospital setting. But because it, two things, because it wasn't as transmissible as what we're observing here with the SARS-2 virus, and because there wasn't any asymptomatic spread, then they were able to contain that first SARS virus. But I can remember really pretty freaking out back in 2003 with that first SARS virus when the lethal rate was like 10-12%. That's catastrophic for a virus if it were to be more transmissible than it was. But the big factor is that there was not asymptomatic spread. And the moment where I realized that how bad this pandemic was going to be, or that it was going to reach the U.S. shores and become widespread, is the moment I read a study from the CDC about a cruise ship that was docked maybe off Japan or somewhere. And they had those people captive on the ship and were able to continually test them. And they documented a whole bunch of asymptomatic spread. And once you have asymptomatic spread, a virus is basically impossible to control because you can't find cases. They're out in the community and they don't know they're infected. So
what if SARS had asymptomatic spread? We would have been in trouble, huh?
Oh, it would have been a horrible, horrible, horrible pandemic.
Wow.
Way worse than this. Way worse. If there had been asymptomatic spread with that virus, because it would have leaked out of the Toronto hospital, it would have gotten into Canada, it would have gotten into the community, it would have spread through asymptomatic contact with people. But that didn't happen. And so we're lucky that it didn't happen. You could find people and get them into isolation. That's the thing. Because you knew they were infected because they had symptoms. But with this thing, there was up to 40% of people who are infected and don't know it. Well, how can you find them if they don't even have any symptoms? So you can't put them in isolation, which means they spread it to other people.
What about the great flu of 1918? What was that asymptomatic spread?
We just don't have enough information and data to really put a handle on exactly how much asymptomatic spread there was. One thing is for sure, they had in those days much worse information about infection control, especially in hospital settings. So there was no such thing as an N95 mask, you know, in those days. And I mean, they did know about hand washing and so forth, but, you know, just infection control generally was much worse. And the infrastructure, you know, I mean, you can imagine, you know, the kinds of things that we have in our hospitals today is something that they could have never dreamed about in 1918. I mean, those were what we would today describe as primitive healthcare conditions, really.
All right, we're going to take a break right here. Will Humble will stick around for our final segment of today. We'll take a break in the Green Thing, Zocalo Village Studio. Be right back with Will with more. 790-2040, we will open up the phone lines if anybody would like to join in with a comment or a question. Now's the time to do it. Be right back.
Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley, proudly announces a second Tucson area location where you'll enjoy locally brewed craft beer and gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, on West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and now at the Doubletree Hotel on Alvernon across from Tucson's Reed Park. More on the web at noblehops.com. When the public weighed in on the first draft of the Regional Transportation Authority Plan, the RTA responded by revising the final plan before voter approval in 2006. The RTA is preparing for a new plan for voter consideration by June 2026 and invites your input on regional transportation priorities. A draft plan will be presented for further public review. Submit your input or learn more at rtanext.com.
Hello, I'm Danette Bewley, CEO of the Tucson Airport Authority. At Tucson International Airport, we're nonstop supporting jobs and prosperity as an economic engine for our entire region. From an innovative and touchless passenger experience to earning the GBAC Star Accreditation, the golden standard for cleanliness, our team is ready to welcome you back to Tucson International Airport. Begin your journey with us. We're nonstop for you, Southern Arizona.
Hi, this is Pam Krim, CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona, where we set the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the place to turn for objective and unbiased information on businesses. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona at bbb.org/Tucson.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Green Things is a family-owned and operated plant nursery serving Tucson since 1970. Open daily at 3384 East River Road, Green Things is chock full of plants and pottery from around the world. Green Things is also now home to Zocalo, featuring fine Mexican and South American imports spread over five buildings on the 13-acre Green Things property. For more, visit greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
We are having just such delightful autumn weather, and so are they over in Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. Elevation 5,500 feet to 7,000 feet. That means cool nights, absolutely gorgeous days, beautiful autumn. Kind of, I guess we're in the mid-autumn now, getting close to late autumn, but temperatures around 70, mid-30s for overnight lows. Yeah, bring a sweater. Take the 3-hour drive over to Silver City. You will not regret it. And do some outdoor hiking in the Gila National Wilderness, just hanging out in Silver City. They've got some beautiful Victorian architecture there. So there's a lot to do. Visit southwestnewmexico.org. It's a good starting place on listing things to do and places to stay. We continue now with our monthly visit with Will Humble, the Director of Marketing and Public Relations, and he's the Executive Director for the Arizona Public Health Association. He's the former Director of the Arizona Department of Health, and we're proud he's part of Team Buckmaster here, one of two dozen regular contributors to our program. Will, we continue now with Will on our live line presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. The emergence of the new antiviral COVID pills from Merck and Pfizer, are these going to be something that people would take as a preventive for COVID, or is this something you would take after you get symptoms?
Well, this would be something that you would take as soon as you get symptoms as possible. Now, they haven't published the data yet, and Pfizer has just released a press release, basically. So we don't know the details of these medications, but they would be something that a person would take at the beginning of symptoms. Say, if you get your PCR test or a rapid antigen test, you find out you're positive, you're having kind of bad symptoms, and especially if you have, you know, a pre-existing condition like heart disease or something, you would probably call in to your primary care doctor, say you were positive, and then they would call in a prescription to your local pharmacy where you could take those pills without even going to a healthcare facility. So it's potentially a super valuable tool, especially for people with pre-existing conditions, like if you're on chemotherapy, if you're going through bone marrow transplant procedures, if you have Down syndrome, something like that. This would be a terrific tool to have, and hopefully it will be at a reasonable cost. Right now, all there really is in terms of treatment is a monoclonal antibody treatment called Regeneron, and our governor has been a big proponent of it. But the retail cost, the wholesale cost of that medication is $2,100.
Wow!
And it needs to be administered in a hospital, but by the time you get the administration fee and the hospital charges and stuff, it's like $10,000.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, for this Regeneron monoclonal antibody treatment. And obviously not cost effective when you compare it to a $20 vaccine. That's why I'm hopeful that these two pills will end up being as effective as their press releases said they are, because they don't need to be taken in a hospital setting. There's no IV. And if the companies don't rip us off, they won't be, you know, extraordinarily expensive like that monoclonal antibody treatment is. By the way, I've been talking to doctors this last week who have been really administering a lot of that Regeneron. And when I told them what it cost, their jaws dropped. They're like, oh, my gosh, I had no idea it cost that much. I'm going to be more careful with who I give this to now, knowing that it's this expensive.
Now, Tamiflu is kind of like if you feel like you got the flu symptoms and if you take it within the first couple of days, it's been remarkably effective for the flu, correct?
I would take away the word remarkably.
Okay.
But it's effective, but not remarkably so.
Okay.
And these two pills that the companies have issued press releases about are similar. They're antiviral medications that interfere with the virus's ability to replicate itself.
Are we dispensing far too many antibiotics? People go to the doctor and they have a virus, something that antibiotics probably aren't going to do anything for, but the physicians want to give the patient something. Many patients feel like if they don't walk away with an antibiotic, they haven't really had a successful visit.
Well, it happens a lot, and not just in the United States. It's a global problem. And the problem is, like we talked about evolution before, about 20 minutes ago, same thing. It's that if you overuse an antibiotic, the bacteria will find a way to be able to thrive even in the presence of that antibiotic over time. Their generations are like viruses. It's out, you know, minutes or hours instead of generations like it is for humans. And so they can evolve much more quickly. And that's why we have this problem with antibiotic resistance, where eventually, what is happening is that antibiotics are becoming less effective over time faster than we are able to create new antibiotics. And that's a bad recipe over the long run, because eventually you lose your ability to have an effective antibiotic against, and especially the MRSA, which you probably heard about, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. It's a staphylococcus bug. And, there are some people that get infected with a kind of MRSA that's even resistant to what's called vancomycin, which is our last silver bullet drug.
Oh, boy.
And that's why it's important to not, you know, prescribe drugs, especially antibiotics, when it's not needed, both in humans and especially in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
These antibiotics are given to chickens and cows and all kinds of farm animals because they grow faster.
Hmm.
Well, that's also creating antibiotic resistant bacteria. So agriculture is as big a, I shouldn't say as big, but is a big, big, big problem with overuse of antibiotics as well as the healthcare system.
All right, Will Humble, we always learn something from your visits. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving to you and yours, and we'll talk to you right around the holidays. Thank you, Will.
All right, take care. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. All right, that will do it for the Buckmaster Show. I'm Bill Buckmaster. On behalf of Will Humble and Tom Fairbanks, all of us saying have a great afternoon. And don't forget, Dave Ramsey is just a couple of minutes away here on KVOI, Tucson's source for trusted local news and talk. Have a great day.